Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, my precious little things. Thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Unflappable Grandma, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And heading downriver towards the microphone is today's very special guest. Let's give a hearty country welcome to film historian Professor James Naramore. Welcome back to FlixWise, Jim.
Thanks, Pauline. Nice to be here.
Listeners will recall that I've had Jim on several previous Sight and Sound entries, including Mulholland Drive, Psycho, and Rear Window. I'm always on the hunt for noir Sight and Sound entries that I can bait Jim with. So listeners can imagine how thrilled I was to find Charles Laughton's 1955 feature, Night of the Hunter, sneaking up through the ranks at number 63 on the critics poll. Though I will say that despite it sharing a number of formal similarities with other low-budget noir crime thrillers, there is something, shall we say, distinct about Laughton's Baroque Southern Gothic fantasy, namely that it's completely bonkers. We're going to talk about Laughton's directorial debut and how on earth he was able to make this hodgepodge of styles and sensibilities into one of the greatest and darkest films ever made. And speaking of directorial debuts, Charles Laughton isn't the only director to knock it out of the park his first time at bat. For our second topic, we're going to discuss our favorite films from first-time directors. And then finally, we'll close things out with some final notes of positivity. All right, Jim, shall we get to paddling?
Sure.
Let's do it. For today's Sight and Sound entry, we've got Charles Laughton's 1955 horror slash noir thriller slash Faulkner-esque fever dream, Night of the Hunter. Based on a novel by Davis Grubb, Laughton and co-screenwriter James Agee penned the scariest ecclesiastical fairy tale ever put to celluloid, though I don't think it has much competition, as the film is an anomaly, especially when thinking about it in terms of classic Hollywood. It tells the story of a pair of youngsters, a brother and a sister named John and Pearl, living in rural, that's a really hard word to say, rural West Virginia during the Great Depression. Their father, Ben Harper, played by Peter Graves, desperate for food, decides to rob a bank. That plan goes about as well as robbing a bank usually does, which is to say, not well at all. He's caught by the authorities and sentenced to hang. But just before they slap the cuffs on him, he tells his children where he hid the money and swears them to secrecy. Whiling away the hours in prison awaiting his hanging date, Ben shares a cell with a strange man with even stranger tattoos who claims to be some kind of preacher. This preacher's name is Reverend Harry Powell, and he's played in all his snake oil lathered glory by Robert Mitchum. Of course, the viewer knows full well that despite his wearing clerical garb, Mr. Powell isn't on the side of the angels. So when he shows up in Ben's West Virginia hamlet and attempts to make Ben's relations his own by marrying Ben's widow, played by Shelley Winters, we know nothing good can come of this. Powell lingers around family picnics and charms the overeager townsfolk. But Harper's kids know what's up, or at least John does. However, despite John's warnings and protestations, Powell is able to con the mother into a toxic, sexless marriage. And it's all the boy can do to ensure that he and his little sister don't reveal the father's secret, while also steeling himself against Powell's constant psychological torment, including threats to murder what's left of his family. The boy holds steadfast to the secret. That is until one day Powell makes good on his threat, and poor Shelley finds herself at the bottom of a riverbed with a gash in her throat. The children then flee their home in desperation, snagging a rowboat and floating downriver in hopes of finding some kind of liberation. And then from there, well, things get really weird. I know. The proceedings up to this point haven't exactly been church on Sunday routine. And to that I respond, the next segment of the movie features a middle-aged shotgun-toting Lillian Gish making direct addresses to camera. As I said in the beginning of this intro, Night of the Hunter is truly a singular work. Not only is it notable for its daring subject matter, but it's also striking to look at. It's a bold, uncompromising vision that's as powerful today as it was back in the 1950s. At least that's my opinion. Jim, what do you think?
So, you know, I'm crazy about this movie.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very liberal about using the term film noir. Anybody wants to call something a film noir is okay with me.
Yeah.
But I would not call this a film noir.
Okay.
Yeah, it's too... it has, you know, as you say, sort of horror movie elements in it. Those elements are worth talking about. It's I break into tears at the end of it almost every time I see it.
Mm.
I think it has as much in common with D.W. Griffith as it does with German Expressionism.
Yeah.
And it's the brilliance of putting those two things together that makes it so unusual and striking.
Exactly.
It's like many really truly great films, I think it's unclassifiable. But if I wanted an excuse to talk about it under the rubric of noir, I would.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. No. I think you're right. I guess we can talk more about what makes something a noir, and then how this sort
yeah,
of
yeah. Well. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Or just yeah. read your book. You know. But
I'm writing another one on that topic right now.
Right.
By the way.
Right. Very exciting.
Yeah.
But. You're right. It does defy classification, and it's difficult because it's so many different things
yeah,
at once.
Yeah,
But let's start from the beginning. When did you first see it? And
I saw it when it came out in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have I have a strong memory of having seen it. I don't remember what my reaction to it was. I one of the memories I also have, I don't know if you're aware of this or your listeners, but I guess at that time, maybe the most popular TV show in America, or certainly one of the most, was Ed Sullivan's variety show, which would come on, I think, Sunday nights. Are you familiar with the old Ed Sullivan show?
I mean, I know it because the Beatles came on and... I know.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
And Elvis was on there.
Right,
you know, yeah,
right,
it was
yeah.
a big deal. Everybody in America tuned in to Ed Sullivan. And one evening he had the cast of Night of the Hunter on there reenacting scenes of the movie on stage. I thought it was very impressive because the film itself has a theatrical quality, a deliberately theatrical quality, and it worked pretty well. I can just remember that. From my childhood.
Interesting. It's interesting that you say it has a theatrical quality. It makes sense because the director, Charles Laughton, had a theatrical background. But there is also, it's also extremely cinematic, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, no.
Yeah.
I would not, yes, it is a movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
But one of the many daring things about it is that it doesn't obey any of the rules of the sort of either classical Hollywood or naturalistic filmmaking. Everything in it is a little over the top.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of, I know we're going to talk more about this in the second segment, but there's
yeah.
something so bold about it. And it's almost rule breaking about it. It defies categorization because maybe because the person who was making it didn't realize that he needed to that the film needed a classification, right? Like you.
Yeah,
sort of
I think he. I think he deliberately set out to make it this way.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to I teach a course on movie acting, and I would start out by asking students what's the difference between theater acting and movie acting, and they would all say, well, movie acting is quiet. Movie acting is you know, naturalistic. You don't try to be stagey about anything. And then I would show them a clip of Robert Mitchum doing the old left-hand, right-hand
yeah.
routine in this film.
Yep.
And, that's stage acting.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely compelling. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about Laughton and how this project came about. And
mm-hmm.
his background as an actor, and that's primarily what I know him as, is this really great British actor.
Yep.
But yeah, do you know how this whole project came about?
Well, Laughton was in Hollywood at the time, and he had been doing a lot of reading tours around the country from sort of great books and everything. He had that wonderful voice. He was a truly great actor and a great screen actor. And yet, a lot of his parts in the movies, he could do with his left hand. They were not he was just being impressive, Charles Laughton. He had a kind of a salon in Hollywood, at his house in Hollywood, where he taught acting. And he even had Charlie Chaplin there once as a guest to, you know, talk to actors. And his producer for his roadshow, I think at that time, was a guy named Paul Gregory, who decided to get into movie producing. And it was through Gregory as the producer that the movie project came about. And that's how Laughton got the gig. And it was Gregory's gift to the world to have Laughton actually make a movie that he cared a lot about.
Sure, yeah. And in making this movie, Laughton was able to collaborate with James Agee, who is a film critic of some note, writer, and screenwriter. And, I mean, there's some disagreement about Agee's actual input on the script, but I think the record shows that he wrote the initial draft and some subsequent drafts, but perhaps a good part of why there's this terrific amalgam of styles is because you have, on the one hand, you have Charles Laughton, who renowned British stage actor turned film actor. And then on the other hand, you have Southern film critic slash writer. And that may in part be why we have this like mishmash of sensibilities.
Well, yeah, I think the different sensibilities are built into the film. Mm-hmm. I think Laughton was in control of all that.
Yeah,
and I think the casting of James Agee was a brilliant stroke. A casting of him as screenwriter.
Yeah,
as you say, there's a debate about it, because Agee gets sole credit for the screenplay, mm-hmm. and Agee was a character I adore. A tremendously talented writer, a great movie critic, a potentially a great novelist. A Death in the Family is the only real finished achievement he has as a novel, and that's really good. Of course, he wrote Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, the photographs of Walker Evans, which is a unique book and a truly powerful one, avant-garde in all kinds of ways. Again, unclassifiable. But as you say, he was a Southerner. He had a lot in common with Davis Grubb, the fellow who wrote the novel that the film is based on. Mm-hmm. And I think for that was one of the reasons that Laughton was interested in Agee as the screenwriter. And so that. Agee wrote several screenplays. The best known one is his collaboration with John Huston on The African Queen.
Right.
But he wrote a number of other screenplays which either didn't make it to the film or did in very revised ways. And as a screenwriter, he was peculiar. He loved movies. He really wanted to direct movies. And if you look at any, not the screenplay, the published screenplay for A Night of the Hunter, but his other screenplays, he would have driven any director mad because he wrote such elaborate screenplays. He would describe, you know, how the light and the glint of a character's eye should look in this shot, and he would become very elaborately descriptive. Some of them are beautiful to read, but they're just, you know, it's as though he wanted to direct the film, and he's got the idea of this film in his head, and he's putting it all out in his most poetic prose. So then that's what he did with this. Much of the dialogue in the movie comes from the Davis Grubb novel. Mm-hmm. But Agee wrote these really elaborate instructions. I forget how long the screenplay was, but
it was towards 300. Yeah, 300 pages like that.
He had some interesting stuff in it, which unfortunately was cut out. He, for example, when John and Pearl go on the trip down river, Agee had to meet a black family, mm-hmm. and that's an interesting moment. And that was eliminated. He had some other great ideas for it, but what ultimately what Agee had in this case was Laughton, who was a terrific editor of what Agee had written, and that's what Agee always needed. He was a writer a little bit. I think he's a better writer than Thomas Wolfe, but he's a little like Thomas Wolfe in that Wolfe wrote these incredibly long, elaborate prosy novels, and Maxwell Perkins, his editor at Scribner's, cut the hell out of them and sort of made Wolfe readable. And in a sense, that's what Lawton did for A.G. on this film. And A.G. wanted to have either co-credit or no credit at all, and let Lawton have the screen credit. But Lawton said no. So
it's funny you say that he is cast as a screenwriter. You know, he didn't come. It's not his story, and it's not his dialogue, but. You know, it's all part of the mixture.
He did contribute stuff to the film. I'm not just saying he transcribed the novel to the page. Not at all.
Yeah. But let's talk about, you know, as you mentioned in the beginning of the segment, that there's this film is equal parts, you know, German Expressionism and E.W. Griffith. It purposefully evokes kind of Americana, Southern. Southern Gothic literature. In what ways does it blend the two? And how do you think he does that successfully? Those two styles seem so incongruous.
I don't know how he does it successfully. I know that he started out wanting somebody, a big star, to play the villain, you know, in the movie, mm-hmm. and the psychotic, demented preacher who carries a switchblade in his pants and has all kinds of sexual problems and likes to murder widows. He originally wanted Gary Cooper to play the part, and he offered it to Gary Cooper, and Cooper turned it down. I think he must have been thinking it would be very interesting to see Gary Cooper play that part.
Sure,
And instead, at Paul Gregory's urging, he said, get Robert Mitchum. And of course, Robert Mitchum is one of the greatest actors there is, mm-hmm. For the movies, and a real SOB apparently in private. I'll read you something that, this is a story you probably have seen before. Lawton goes to Robert Mitchum and he says, Mitchum, I'm directing this film, and there's a character in it who is a diabolical shit. And Mitchum says, present.
Yeah. Yep. At least he was a self-aware shit, you know.
And Mitchum is so terrific in this movie. Mm-hmm. He loved Lawton. The two of them got along, got gangbusters, and so anyway, you've got this. How would you describe it? This kind of really powerful. It's a strange performance because it's not a realistic performance, no. But it's a scary performance. And then midway through the movie, he meets Lillian Gish.
I know. What?
yeah. And oh man, the minute she comes in the movie, my heart melts. And the confrontation between her character and Mitchum's character is just—it's fabulous. She is pure good, and he is pure evil. What happened was, I guess Lawton and A.G., when they were working on the film, they went to the Museum of Modern Art and screened all of D.W. Griffith's movies. Mm-hmm. And so, right from the beginning, what Lawton wanted to do was have this. Old kind of still in touch with the country. By country, I mean as opposed to the city, kind of feeling that is generated from those Griffith movies. And Lawton had, as a young man, he was nuts about Lillian Gish. And so here she is. How does he put those two things together? They're in those two performances. I don't know. The design of the film borrows a lot from German Expressionism, these very deep shadows and the strange sets. everything looks very stagey. The river looks fake.
Yeah.
The little animals that are playing look fake. That ought to draw you away. But there's kind of an overused term, but there's a kind of Brechtian quality to what Mitchum does.
Mm-hmm.
You feel that it's a stylized performance,
yeah,
but it's a smart performance, and sometimes it becomes like a Warner Brothers cartoon. There's this chase scene in it where it could be like Abbott and Costello Meet the Monster or
sure.
something like that.
You know, when he's running up the basement steps.
Yeah. Okay. And but it works.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry.
You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a cartoon.
And Lillian Gish's world is just as artificial as that expressionist world. It's this little old house with ducks going by
sure.
and children. And
yeah.
it's just so, you say, this is so cornball, but it breaks my heart every time I see it.
Yeah. It does work. It's, the tattoos incarnate. Love and hate. This film, it works because it acknowledges the heart of artifice, as you say, in that Brechtian way. But it sort of it makes it feel very otherworldly.
It has this really, as you said before, I think it has this very strong fairy tale quality to
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah,
and because it's told from the point of view of children, I think that's why I accept the artificiality of it. You know, it has a magical, strange atmosphere to it.
Sure.
Anyway.
Yeah. And so I guess we can talk about what the film is actually about, which I mean, it's difficult to, I don't want to say it's about one thing necessarily, but certainly in the mix is a film about spirituality and religion and good versus evil. And
yeah.
I'm wondering what do you think Lawton was trying to convey about the nature of religion and specifically Christianity?
Yeah. Well, I think Lawton was not himself coming to it from the point of view of Christianity. He wasn't trying to preach a sermon or anything like that.
Yeah.
I think and his version of Christianity, I guess you could say there are two versions of Christianity. One is the preacher's version, which is cruel, the vengeful God, the scary God. And the other is the I would say more Christ-like, but more the gentle aspects of Christianity, the mm-hmm. goodness in Christianity. Also, Christianity as a religion of love, and love meaning, whereas the preacher has a kind of twisted erotic quality to the love about him, the love that Lillian Gish represents is. The love of charity, you know, mm-hmm. it's what the Bible called charity, which is the greatest of all virtues.
Yeah.
So it's not a, it's using these Christian elements because the world that the film takes place in is a world saturated with those beliefs and those ideas. There's this wonderful speech that Lillian Gish makes at one point. And it was not in Davis Grubb's novel. And I don't know whether A.G. or Lawton thought it up, but it's that scene where she's the mother to a bunch of orphans.
Right.
And she's a little family of orphans. And there's this teenage girl who is attracted to a boy. And she sort of does something bad with the boy. And Lillian Gish doesn't fuss at her. She says, no, what you did was love.
Yeah.
And that's the message of the film. So anyway, but the other thing I think is important, while we're talking about all this kind of more or less religious element in the film, the film is really wide open to a Freudian interpretation as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a dream film, and it's about a boy, chiefly a boy, who sees his father tied up and taken off to prison. And he has this image of the good father the sort of blonde, white-haired father, and then that father becomes a cruel father, mm-hmm. and he has a mother. I don't know what to say about her.
Yeah,
Shelley Winters is like she at this point in her career, she was a character that everybody wanted to murder for one reason.
Yeah, what yeah. is that?
Yeah. She always plays these rather annoying or dim-witted women who get bumped off.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, yeah.
So, I guess we should say A Place in the Sun and
Place in the Sun,
Lolita.
Lolita.
Right, yeah.
But anyway, it's like the mother is sort of dim-witted and neglecting of the children and infatuated with the preacher when he comes along.
Right.
And so the boy's journey is from this idealized image of a father to this evil father, and also from this rather weak mother to Lillian Gish, who becomes right. his mother at the end of the film. So there's I don't know how to, you can go in various directions with this, but there's an Oedipal element in the film.
Yeah.
But I think this where the religious thing is also balanced with this, I guess you could call a psychological drama, a male character divided between these worlds.
Right. So there, I guess that's what we can grab onto, psychologically speaking. Just like so that it doesn't become pure abstraction.
Right.
It's not fable. Yeah.
Right. Right. I think when we're watching it. It deals with the most powerful stereotypes. But it's an adult film, the great thing about it is it never digs you in the ribs with any of this. It plays it very straight, pure.
Sure.
It has all the elements of, you know, the grim fairy tales or the scary fairy tale.
Exactly.
But you're coming out at the end of it. I don't know if you can say John is in the best state in the world, but.
Better than where he started.
Oh man, I just go to pieces at the end when he gives Lillian Gish that gift.
Oh,
yeah.
We have to talk about Lillian Gish because she is wonderful. I don't know what I guess her career kind of slowed to a halt after the silent era.
She was still acting. She was still acting, and she. I guess there's this story that late in her life, she was in a movie with Betty Davis. I can't remember.
Right. Was that, oh God. What was that? But I love that story.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something about a close up. And Betty Davis says, "Are you kidding? The bitch invented the close-up."
Betty Davis has she's just the best, and it's true. I've heard a story about I think Betty Davis was like in her 70s at that point, and Lillian Gish was she was like in her 90s or something at the time of that film.
Yeah.
And I remember a story about Betty Davis complaining that Miss Gish doesn't know her lines. She's 90 years old. She didn't need words when she was on screen.
I guess it could have been another Crawford Gish feud, except that Gish didn't care.
Right, exactly. She was not about to indulge that. Betty Davis making enemies on every film set. God bless her. It's a shame that she didn't find as much work as I would have liked.
One would like. I mean, there are so few good parts for somebody like that.
Sure, yeah.
And she actually, I can't believe I missed this, but she came to Bloomington, Indiana, sometime in the 70s.
Oh my God!
Made a personal appearance, and I can't remember what that was about. But everybody said she was ageless. Even when she was a very old woman, she still had that girlish face that she had with Griffith. There was a kind of I don't know. I mean, I don't think she ran laps or took skin treatments or anything, but she always looked, She always looked good.
Yeah, it's so striking to see her face because so much, like, I guess her carriage is, like, changed slightly. She looks frailer, but the face is the same.
Yeah, she's great in this movie because she has that kind of erect carriage, you know.
Yeah.
And she's, you feel that she's a woman who would be a mother who would give you a spanking but still love you.
There's a sense of, like, the wizened Lillian Gish is, like, a good look for her. It was just pitch-perfect casting. And I would say there's a kind of, maybe you disagree, but I'd say there's, a certain naturalism to the performance as compared with Robert Mitchum.
With Mitchum, that's right. I think that's right. Although, as you say, there are these moments where she has direct address to the camera.
Right.
And you feel that she's, you know, delivering lines in what is it, that speech she makes at the end about little children.
Little things, yeah.
Yeah, they survive and they endure.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I don't think that's delivered naturalistically.
No,
it's just so the interplay between her and Mitchum is just so wonderful. I don't think to me she's still being Lillian Gish.
I mean, it's true. Like, it couldn't be more on the nose, as we say. Like, how does he combine film noir and D.W. Griffith? Well, he hires the most famous actress from D.W. Griffith's films, and he hires this famous, you know, anti-hero of film noir. So it's like such a stroke of genius, and somehow it all works together. So I guess that was, I think we've touched on most of the things that I wanted to talk about. I know, just briefly to get back to what you were saying about film noir, film noir can be defined so broadly.
To cut it short, the term film noir, it comes from the French and the French critics and their own cinema, and the film noir was related to what they call the roman noir, the Gothic novel, and they had already in the 30s films that they called noir, and particularly the surrealists in France were attracted to these kinds of films. Horror in those days was more lyrical than it is today, more poetic. King Kong is fascinating because of that quality, and that's why the French surrealists loved it so much. When they saw the 40s private eye movies and so forth, they saw some of that quality in them, and they labeled American film noir before the Americans even thought of the term. But the way they defined it was, you know, in different ways, affectively. The way it works is there is no single set of necessary and sufficient characteristics to define a film noir. Too many different kinds of films have been called film noir. There is nothing other than a kind of a dark quality of tone or mood that these films share. Not even crime. Some of the things that have been called film noir are not crime films. Why that happens is that the film noir was defined by lists. The French saw these five American movies in succession right after World War II, and they saw they had things in common, but A has something in common with B, B has something in common with C, D has something in quality, and so forth. And as you move down the list, you're going to find things in it that aren't, they're different. So, for example, one of those first five films was The Lost Weekend. Now, The Lost Weekend doesn't have a hell of a lot in common with The Maltese Falcon.
No, not so much.
But they called it a film noir. And that's what, you know, and the other thing is about the film noir, you can always discover new ones, or you can go back to find early old films. Oh, you see, that's a film noir. So it's fine if you want to use that term, but don't expect that you're going to be able to define neatly what film noir is.
Yeah, fair.
Okay.
Yeah. One last thing I forgot to bring up, the cinematographer is Stanley Cortez.
Right.
And I wonder if we can just talk briefly about some of his other films that he shot. and right. sort of most, what he brings to it.
Yeah. Right. His most famous film, of course, is Magnificent Ambersons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a story about that, and you may know this. Welles had gone from Citizen Kane with Greg Toland, and I actually think Greg Toland did a few of the shots in Ambersons, one in particular. But he hired Cortez because Cortez had worked on relatively low-budget movies and was a very fast worker. And he wanted, in this film, he had other projects in mind and so forth, but he wanted a good photographer who could do things fast. And the minute Cortez, who was something of an aesthete and a dandy and a self-made intellectual, got together with Orson Welles, he became a Mr. Particular, and Welles was tearing his hair out about it. He was very upset about it. So he hired a bunch of other photographers to fill in for him. So there are at least three other photographers on Ambersons, but I think there is a Stanley Cortez style, and I don't know, I can recognize it, but I'm not sure I can explain what I'm seeing. I would say I think that it's a little bit more high contrast than say somebody like Greg Toland. Mm-hmm. That there's not a lot of mid range in the lighting and the texture of the image, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of strong blacks and whites in them. He also did a lot of photography for Sam Fuller,
right,
in the B movies that Sam Fuller did. And those films have that kind of very stark, I think, black and white. Not a lot of subtlety or shading in the lighting.
Right.
But anyway.
Yeah.
And that works in this film, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. That's all part of the mixture. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think that brings us to the final question. This film is the 63rd film on the Sight and Sound International Critics Poll. Is it worthy of the 63rd spot?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Are you kidding? I mean, hey, you and I have practically been gushing over it mm-hmm. for an hour here. And,
sure.
It could be number one as far as that goes.
There you go.
And that's the way I look at these lists. And hey, I could have made it one of my top 10. I didn't.
Yeah.
But I could
Next
have
time.
Easily. Yeah.
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 Yeah. I mean, we've had a great stretch of movies recently. We had The Mother and the Whore, which is not my favorite. But we had Barry Lyndon.
Oh man, that's my favorite Kubrick movie. Yeah.
It's mine.
You should have had me.
Yeah, I know. I should have had you. No. Oh dear. Well, next Kubrick, I'm giving you a call. We had Sherlock Jr., which again, I really think that could be number one.
Sure.
So it's been a terrific stretch. And coming down the pike here, we have Rio Bravo, we have Modern Times, we have Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous that you have to make up a top 10 list. Isn't
it's
it?
Very true. But it's an honor to do it, I suppose.
Yeah.
Honor to be asked. 63rd seems too low.
This could take long, but one day she flew away, flew away. She had two pretty children, but one night these two pretty children flew away.
Next up, we have favorite directorial debuts. Pretty self-explanatory, I think. We're going to talk about filmmakers whose first time behind the camera yielded a masterpiece, or at least something close to a masterpiece. Obviously, we've already covered Charles Laughton, so he's out. And there's a chance we might even talk about someone besides Orson Welles. Slim
yeah,
chance.
I mean, if the category is debuts, okay, yeah. We already know we're going to do it that one. Yeah.
I mean, I'm okay if we just want to have a whole segment on Orson Welles again. Why not?
That's okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I think he's as good a place to start as any. You know, Citizen Kane being the ultimate debut film.
No need to even comment about that. I mean, that's the splashiest debut I can think of.
Yeah.
But if the category of, I got kind of mixed up about this category. I'll give you an example of a debut film that I think is by a well-known director that I think is interesting and not many people have seen. Mm-hmm. There are also some other directors like Lawton who only made one film.
Yeah.
And I got a couple of those I'd like to talk about.
Absolutely. Please do.
Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah. What are some that one and done?
One and done?
Yeah.
I may have talked about this or mentioned it before, but Barbara, do you know Barbara Loden's film, Wanda?
Yes. Did she? Oh, gosh. You know what? You're right. She hasn't made another film.
That's it.
Wow.
She died not too long after that.
Wow.
And I don't know if your listeners know very much about this film. A woman in Appalachia who's got kids who leaves her husband and goes on the road, winds up with a petty criminal and a bank robber, and it's a kind of anti Bonnie and Clyde movie, say. It's unique, it's brilliant. It was shot in 16mm, although it's a color film. Barbara Loden was the actress wife of Elia Kazan. And Kazan, kind of in his autobiography, kind of poo-poos this film. I think it's a better movie than Elia Kazan ever thought about making. This thing could easily be in my top 10 on the
On your list. I can't believe I didn't think about that. Yes, you're right. You are absolutely right. Oh, I think a lot of our listeners will be familiar with that film just because we do so much work on just female directors. But that's a great example. Wow.
Yeah.
Are there any other?
Another one I'm going to mention that may surprise you, I don't know, but Marlon Brando only directed
that's
one movie.
That's true. Yes, indeed. Yeah. I've actually never seen it. One-Eyed Jax.
Oh, really?
Right?
Yeah, you've never seen One-Eyed Jax?
I've never seen it.
There's a really nice Blu-ray out for that now, and I love that movie.
Okay.
It's a bit of a mess because Brando lost. He made a much longer movie. A movie with a more downbeat ending, and the studio didn't like it, and Brando just kind of walked away. And it's one of my favorite westerns. I don't know where to stop. I would talk too long about it. The cast is great.
Go on.
Carl Malden is cast as the villain in it. It's against type. He's wonderful. And it has another villain in it. It's Timothy Carey. Do you know who Timothy Carey was?
I don't know if I do.
Timothy Carey was a great actor. He only played. But you'll know when I tell you. He's in Paths of Glory. He plays this sort of, how to explain it, a unique sort of character, the one who kills a roach at one point in the movie. Mm-hmm. He worked for John Cassavetes. He also another movie he's in with Kubrick was The Killing. He plays the guy who shoots the racehorse in The Killing.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yeah.
He has this really creepy looking face.
Yes.
He's in this Brando movie.
Okay.
And there's so many good things, and his great lines of dialogue, like "Get up, you scum sucking pig," and he didn't give me no selection. Anyway, I love that movie.
Okay, that's another great one.
Brando's only one. Yeah.
That's a shame then.
Yeah.
He gave up too early.
Yeah. I don't think he had the temperament to be a director.
That makes sense. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. Were there any other ones you wanted to mention?
I'll just mention one of the films as a debut film.
Okay.
Have you ever seen Billy Wilder's first film?
I've seen. Is it the one I'm thinking of there's one like People on Sunday, but that's a
No, People on Sunday. He worked on People on Sunday, but he wasn't the sole director of that movie. Yeah, and actually had an assistant co-credit on this other film, which really is, can be called his first film. And he made it in Paris right after leaving Germany from the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
It was 1934. It's called Mauvaise Graine, or Bad Seed. And it's like the new wave 30, 40 years ahead of time. It's shot in the streets in Paris. It's kind of zany and strange and got jazz music in it. And I think it's really fun.
Yeah.
Wilder puts it down. He never says very much about it. But Cameron Crowe, who did this interview book with Wilder, talks about it. And I think it's a really fascinating film.
Okay.
By the way, Billy Wilder did not like Night of the Hunter. He said, wow. Lawton was trying to pack too much into that film.
Interesting.
He just didn't get it. Anyway.
Yeah. Huh. I mean, I could see how it wouldn't. I could see how maybe it, like, it's antithetical to Wilder's sensibilities. It's so earnest.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah, right. But I think a lot of people didn't get it. It was a total flop when it came out.
Yeah.
It took years for people to come around to realize how good that film is.
Yeah, yeah. Back to debut films.
Okay, your turn now.
My turn, not to list off a couple. The one that immediately jumped to my mind is Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Cause you like that?
I love that movie, and I don't think he made a better movie.
I've never been a fan. I've never been a fan of Mike Nichols, but
that's fair. Yeah,
no, it's fine. I'm sorry. I don't mean to.
That's okay.
Your...
Yeah, no. I mean, but yeah. I'm not a huge fan of The Graduate. I like that movie. I mean, Postcards from the Edge. I have a huge soft spot for, but mostly because of the screenwriter. But
that's fun. That's fun. Yeah.
But I love Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Really?
Yeah. Nice. I don't know. I think I love. Maybe it just like. I love Elizabeth Taylor in that mode.
Uh-huh. I'll have to go look at it again. Now,
yeah, so. Yeah. Maybe, you know, it's surprising to me that, because I do think that film has a lot of detractors, but I'm very fond of it. But also, I mean, I'm surprised you didn't mention Killer of Sheep.
Oh. Yeah, of course. Yeah, where have I heard of that film before?
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Yeah, yeah. It's another good one.
Is my face red?
I mean, I think maybe it just goes without saying.
Yeah, not only a masterpiece on the first shot, but also the greatest student film ever made.
Sure. So, yeah. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But. I can come back to naming more, but I just wonder, maybe we can talk about like how we judge debut films and whether I get the sense that when we talk about a debut, it's not quite the same as when a debut film is not quite the same as when we talk about, say, like a debut novel or something like that, a debut play.
Well, they're you know, first novels are. My son just got a bit of an award for a first novel.
So. Wow, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess we do acknowledge that, you know, first-time directors, there are awards given to that. More and more so lately. But there's a sense that a debut novel may not necessarily be indicative of the director's overall sensibility. I don't know. Do you think that there's just more leeway given?
We only know that in retrospect, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how to say that. I guess when you see a first-time director, you go in without any particular expectations.
Yeah.
But I think if the film is good, it's good.
Yeah.
And you realize it is. So,
yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah. I guess there's also a sense that, you know, a person writing a novel has been writing his debut novel, his or her debut novel for their entire life.
No.
No, you don't think so?
Yeah, too many different novelists to do. No, I wouldn't say that.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway.
I guess, yeah, it's more, to me, it's like a film director... It's more catch-as-catch-can kind of thing. You'll take any job. a lot of the time, right? It's rare to be in a
situation.
Oh, of course.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, no, so a lot of it has to do with how much control. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, in the case of the films we've been talking about, obviously, Wells had tremendous control over Kane. Charles Burnett had tremendous control over Killer of Sheep. And Lawton had a lot of control over his film.
Yeah.
But the industry doesn't usually work that way.
It's
and
true.
Even people who we know had that freedom to begin sometimes don't have it later. So,
right. Yeah,
anyway,
it's true. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe at the same time, a lot of attention is paid to a promising debut.
Sure.
And maybe there are instances where that can work to the director's benefit, or it can sort of stymie them.
Wells had to live with Citizen Kane the rest of his life.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. How do you live up to Citizen Kane?
Well, I think he did live up to
it,
but he was always told that he wasn't living up
right.
to it. Anyway, yeah.
Right, yeah. And then there's the, can you think of other examples where the first film is the best film?
Well, I wouldn't say in the case of Charles Burnett that Killer of Sheep is necessarily his best film. It's one of his best films.
Sure.
I like To Sleep with Anger just as much.
Sure.
But
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's a great one. But back to a few more of my favorites. I really like The Watermelon Woman, Cheryl Dunn.
You know, I've never seen that film.
I like that
one quite
a bit. Uh-huh. That one I absolutely think is worth checking out.
Okay.
I don't know. She hasn't had as much opportunity as she should have to make subsequent films, so it's hard to say if what her career would have done if she'd been given those opportunities. But and I think that's the case with a lot of women directors in the 80s and 90s. And,
sure.
You know, that's how that goes. Speaking of women directors, Agnès Varda's first film, I'm going to mispronounce it, so forgive me, La Panque Courte. Is that how you say it?
You know, I, once again, I don't think I've seen that.
Okay.
I always thought Cleo.
Yeah.
5 to 7. Yeah.
I did too, but I actually recently saw La Panque. I don't know. I can't pronounce it. I'm terrible with French pronunciations.
Yeah,
I just cannot do it.
Yeah.
But that was made in 1955, which, of course, precedes all of the French New Wave.
Sure.
Yeah, hullabaloo.
Yeah.
You know, it goes without saying that something like The 400 Blows is a very, very strong debut.
Yeah, but he had made a short film before
right?
Yeah.
Godard made a film before Breathless, but it was short.
I don't know if it counts, but Breathless is,
First debut feature. Very impressive. But all of those guys, they kind of knocked it out first time at bat, right? The Hiroshima Mon Amour. They just seemed to know exactly what they were doing.
I should have done more homework and looked up people's credits before we started.
That's okay.
I wasn't sure, you know, is Alice in the City's Vim Vendors his first movie? I don't know. Probably not.
Yeah.
You know, I always thought that, for example, what the guy that did Moonlight. I thought that was his first film, but he made an earlier film.
He
Medicine
for Melancholy.
Yeah.
The earlier one. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting to think about what a first film means and how it relates to the rest of their career. But you're right that it is almost more interesting in retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any others that you wanted to throw out there?
No. We could go on talking.
We could
about
go
this,
on
no,
all
like, yeah,
day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, listeners, you can let us know if we've left any off. Like
I'm sure they will. Yeah.
Give us a shout. Oh, but I should say this one's for Martin, our co-producer. Story of a 3-Day Pass, Melvin Bad People's debut film. That's a great movie. All right, it's time we take this show on the road. But before we do, let's make sure we close things out on a positive note. Jim, tell me about a piece of pop culture, or any kind of culture, really, that you've recently enjoyed or admired.
Well, last night I went to a great jazz concert. One good thing about Bloomington is that it has a great music school. It's one of the best music schools in the country. And every year their jazz people put on a concert. And this year a guy came back to do it. He's a bassist named John Clayton. He's been in the business for a long time. He won at least one Grammy, and he's worked with just about everybody you can think of. And anyway, it was a terrific, terrific evening. I love jazz, and I could go on and on about what happened there. So it was great.
Sure,
I'm reading John O'Hara, who I'd never read before, and it is really pretty good. And I'm reading a Nabokov novel called Panin. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. I've never read that one before. That one's funny.
All right.
And I'm every 5 years I reread Rex Stout, the Negro Wolf novels. I'm crazy about them.
Okay.
So that's what I've been doing.
Yeah.
And today I had a great cultural experience this afternoon. Turner was showing Clooney Brown, the Lubitsch movie.
Ah.
And Lubitsch can do no wrong for me.
That is true. I think Lubitsch is going to come up again in our next podcast, so stay tuned, listeners.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I have two. I've been kind of stressed out lately. I've had some big, big decisions to make, personal decisions, which I'll probably fill you in on later. But the thing that's been kind of soothing my anxiety is like silly television shows. And so I've been watching iZombie, which I'm very happy to say is back on the CW. Mm-hmm. CW continues to be the finest network television, or finest network on, what is it? It's like network television, I guess is what it's called.
Yeah, it's hard to say nowadays.
Yeah, yeah.
Cable, I guess. Right?
Yeah, yeah, but it's not on cable. If it's not cable, it's network, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess. It's broadcast.
Exactly,
yeah.
Broadcast mm-hmm. network. And then the other thing is chewing gum, which is a British import. And
I've heard of that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And so I guess a lot of people really liked Fleabag last year. And I'm mm-hmm. here to say that if you like Fleabag, you should definitely check out chewing gum.
Uh-huh.
Because I think it's
good.
A little bit better. And it's Michaela Cole is the showrunner, and it's a young 20-something, I think that's her name, mm-hmm. but it's about a young 20-something woman living in a London housing project, and her various misadventures and trying to lose her virginity, it's also about her non-romantic relationships and the other people living in the building, including her evangelical Christian mother and sister, so it's a good time, it's funny, poignant, check it out, it's
good.
On Netflix.
Good.
All right.
Did you see Sneaky Pete?
I didn't. Should I check that one out?
I like that one a lot.
You like that one? Okay. Maybe I'll look. I'm always a little bit skeptical of the Amazon shows. I don't know why.
Really?
I don't know why.
Well,
there's no reason.
Give it a try.
Okay, I will. And that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what do you make of Night of the Hunter? Pretty great, right? Come tell us how much you dig it on our website, flickswise.com. Or you can like us and leave us a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. And if what we're doing here on the show is speaking to your soul, you should probably come follow our merry band of parishioners on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, please, please implore the good people at Apple to look out for us little podcasts by going to the iTunes store and giving our show a good rating and leaving us a nice comment. If you don't, the NPR owls are going to eat us alive. And then you'll have our blood on your hands. My threats just keep getting stranger and stranger. I don't know. On our next show, we have another Charlie Chaplin entry on the Sight and Sound list. This time it's number 63, Modern Times. But until then, Jim, it was a pleasure having you on the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, I guess we didn't really have time to talk about your latest film noir project.
No, that's okay. It's doing one of those little very short introductions. I don't know if you've ever seen them that Oxford puts out, those little tiny books.
Right.
Very short introduction to Hegel and
Right.
Okay, mine's about film noir, so I'm just going to be repeating myself, but adding a few things.
All right. I'm looking forward to that. And I guess you'll – when is that going to come out?
I'm just starting writing.
Just starting it. Okay. So yeah, we'll stay tuned. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And then I'll have to look for more film noirs for you to jump on for.
Okay.
We'll see. Or non-film noirs.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Great. Until then, we abide.